Single moms, high-powered attorneys, brave teenagers, politicians' wives, prostitutes, and nuns. Rekha Basu has written about them all. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, I'll talk with Rekha Basu about her new book, Finding Her Voice, a collection of Des Moines Register columns about women's struggles and triumphs in the Midwest. Since coming to Iowa in 1991, she's written about women from all walks of life, sometimes shedding light in the dark corners of our society, sometimes sharing stories of triumph. This hour, I'll talk to her about the women she's written about and her own journey. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1991, Rekha Basu moved to Iowa, and for the past 20 years, she's been writing about Iowans and Iowa issues as a columnist for the Des Moines Register. Today, we're going to focus on what she's written about women over the years. She's just published a new book, Finding Her Voice, a collection of Des Moines Register columns about women's struggles and triumphs in the Midwest. Rekha, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm absolutely delighted to be here, Charity.
Let's go back to when you first moved to Iowa. In the introduction of the book, you write about being somewhat surprised by what you perceived as a lack of activism in Iowa. What were your first impressions?
So first of all, to give you a little context about where I was coming from, I was raised in a very feminist household. My mother worked for the United Nations and was actually the one who wrote the Global Plan of Action for the first International Women's Year. She worked in the Women's Emancipation Department. My sister is a professor of women's studies, has written a book about women's protest movements. So that was the kind of environment in which I was raised. There was an assumption that we were all feminists, that we all believed in women's rights and agitating for women's rights. And when I first came to Iowa, it seemed to me that there was a kind of silence surrounding women's rights violations that really surprised me. I didn't get it. I mean, I saw that women were doing wonderful acts of charity and compassion, that there were efforts to network. For example, my predecessor, a columnist at the Register, Julie Gamick, was pulling women together for women's potlucks and brown bags to share experiences and to help support women who are running for office. But there wasn't, there wasn't much sort of expression of outrage against real assaults on women's rights that I saw taking place. And I'm talking about domestic violence, about sexual harassment, about inequality in the workplace and so on. So when I started to write about those issues with a real sense of outrage, I got a bit of pushback. And some people, frankly, weren't comfortable with what they saw as my arrogance coming in and telling Iowa women how to feel or how to react to things. I came to understand that there was a different style, that there's something called Iowa Nice, which represents sort of a much kinder, gentler, softer way of dealing with issues. But I also came to find out that there is a great deal of activism taking place under the surface that's not really heralded or covered enough. And so I started covering it.
And with 20 years in Iowa and so many experiences, when you look back at that time in retrospect, do you think that maybe had you been particularly interested in men's issues, you would have found the same thing?
The same kind of activism?
Or the same kind of quiet?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. A lot of what I wrote about was injustices, institutional injustices towards women. I was looking for a response on the part of both women and men to those injustices towards women. I think men generally control the power, and so they don't have to be as outspoken when it comes to issues of discrimination and prejudice, unless, of course, we're talking about certain sectors of men who are not as empowered, men of color, men in poverty, men incarcerated, and so on.
When you got here, I can only imagine, we're talking about your perceptions, but when you arrived, a young, beautiful, educated woman from the big city who is so unafraid to speak her mind and has such strong opinions, how did people react to you in Iowa?
You know, the first column that I wrote about this issue was pretty soon after I arrived, and it was headlined, "Where is Des Moines Women's Anger About Social Issues?" And I found a lot of anger, and a lot of it was directed towards me. You know, women said, "Don't tell us we're not angry. We're angry, but we don't feel..." A lot of women said that they didn't feel that it was safe to speak out. And some women silently would express to me... You know, I remember a female CEO who, you know, appeared to have all the power in the world pulling me aside one day and saying, "If only I could sit down and tell you, I have so much rage I almost want to burst sometimes, but I can't. I can't share my experiences." And then there were women who had some economic power who were doing things in their own way, like the late Cappy Spencer, who was a board member on various organizations, was a big landowner. And, you know, she contacted me and said and told me about her work within boards to try to get, for example, gender equality on Iowa state government boards and commissions and local boards and commissions, which was something really remarkable that she had done. She had waged kind of a one-woman campaign. She waged another campaign to get simply to allow women to have their own names published in the Des Moines phone directory, which wasn't allowed at the time. You had to be a part of your husband's. If you had a husband, you had to be under his last name. So things like that were going on. But then, you know, from the other side, people who didn't want to hear about these issues or talk about gender discrimination, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of, you know, "You don't understand us. You're a New Yorker. You're bringing your New York values to bear on us. They don't apply here. We don't have the kinds of problems that you have, you know, in your home country, India, where women are really, you know, disempowered. Our women are doing just fine." So there was that.
How long do you think, and maybe you don't feel this today, but how long do you think it took to make that shift from being the outside voice to being someone that a lot of Iowa women felt could speak for them?
You know, that's a very, very interesting question. And I think it happened in stages. I think that one stage was when my family and I, in 2001, decided to leave Iowa. We moved to Florida and lived there for a year. My husband and I were both columnists for a newspaper down there. And we really missed Iowa. And at the end of that year, we decided to come back. And the Register was very kind and invited us to come back. And I think that was one stage at which Iowans realized we really love this community. We really felt invested in this community. And one of the things that we missed the most in South Florida was the intense sense of community that Iowans have and that we didn't see down there. And so I think that there was a certain element of trust that came about when we came back, that people didn't think we were just, you know, going someplace for better career opportunities or trying to climb the ladder, you know, on the backs of Iowans, but rather that we really did embrace this community and that we wanted to be here. And then I think another change came actually after my husband passed away in 2006, when people told me, and I'm not entirely sure that I see this in my own writing, but people told me that they saw a slight change of tone in the way I wrote, that it was a bit more personal and a bit more putting myself on the line, putting myself out there, making myself vulnerable, I guess, by talking about some of my own struggles to deal with his death and to deal with widowhood and so on, so that I wasn't just writing about women as the other out there who are experiencing these things, but rather I sort of became the subject of my own columns, and I was able to look at myself with a certain degree of dispassion and my life in the way that I was doing with other women. So I was subjecting myself, I guess, to the same kind of scrutiny that I was subjecting other people to, and I think that that led to a bit more of a trusting relationship as well.
That's so interesting, because I would think that your job as a columnist would be a very vulnerable job, even if you're not writing about yourself. Do you feel that way?
Not really. I mean, I did initially when there was a lot of hate mail. I guess it was hard to take. You really have to develop a thick skin about it and to understand that when you're taking strong points of view and you're challenging people to the core of their values and where they live, then you are going to get some people fighting back, and that's okay, you know, that it's more important to touch people, whether it's, you know, making them outraged or making them delighted rather than leave them indifferent. And so I guess I started to take it as a mark of success that anybody would sit down in a world where everyone is so busy and so stressed for time, sit down and actually compose a lengthy letter to share how outraged they were about something I had written, whether positively or negatively, whether in a way that would lead them to take action to force some kind of institutional change or simply to express their anger towards me for writing something.
There are so many different kinds of columnists and different ways to be a columnist. What was your original mandate with the Register?
You know, I came to the Register actually as an editorial writer initially, and I did that for the first 2 years. But all the while I was filing signed opinion pieces, you know, maybe one day a week. And I guess my particular style was to take a personal anecdote, a personal story of someone I had interviewed and knew something about, and try to extrapolate larger societal messages from it. So in that way, to bring home an issue and make it real to people and put it in people's faces, make it personal. And I guess the Register liked that approach, and so they asked me early on to develop it into a full-time column, and so I became a columnist. And, you know, I mean, I've written about so many issues, but my mandate is my own. It's driven internally, and that is to write about human rights, to advocate for human rights, women's rights, to spotlight issues of social injustice, of inequality, to write about other, quote-unquote, communities, immigrants, poor people, and so on, who don't get enough coverage, and to give them a voice, and hence the title of this book, Finding Her Voice.
Do you have the freedom to basically write about anything you want to write about?
I really, really do. Complete and absolute freedom. I've never been told what to write about or been silenced from writing about a particular issue that I cared about. It's a really, really wonderful, privileged position to be in, I have to say.
How do you decide what to write about?
You know, you would think that that would be a problem sometimes, but there has never, never been a week or a day. And I write three columns a week for the paper that I've come up dry. Usually it's more topics than I can handle in a given week. And I think part of the reason for that is that the topics can be so varied. I can do everything from write about an experience involving one of my kids in sports when they were home, living at home, now they're grown up, and sort of a lesson that I got from watching one of them compete in a sports meet, to writing about a movie that I saw, to writing about global politics, women's development, writing off the news. And then actually a large number of column ideas come from readers. I would say at least 60% are stories that of people struggling with some issue in their own lives who have encountered some kind of stumbling block and want me to write about it and to highlight some systemic imbalance, injustice, or failure of the system to work in their behalf.
I'm talking with Rekha Basu. She is a columnist for the Des Moines Register, and she's just released a new book, Finding Her Voice, a collection of Des Moines Register columns about women's struggles and triumphs in the Midwest. It brings together 20 years worth of columns about Iowa women and Iowa's women's issues. And you're welcome to join our conversation today. You can call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Des Moines Register columnist Rekha Basu. She's just released a new book, Finding Her Voice, a collection of Des Moines Register columns about women's struggles and triumphs in the Midwest. And you're welcome to join our conversation today at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Rekha, just before the break, we were talking about where you get ideas for your columns. Mm-hmm. And when you choose to write about something, what is your process? I mean, obviously, there are many different topics when you're writing about a sports event. That's very different than profiling someone. But if you pick a person that something has happened to, what is your process?
So, I mean, usually what I'm looking for is the story behind the story, the piece of this that is untold. And I'll just give you an example. Actually, today's column. Today's column is about this horrible murder-suicide involving an NFL member, Jovan Belcher. The story broke over the weekend. He was with the Kansas City Chiefs, and I don't follow sports, I have to say, very closely, but I did notice this one. It was on the front page of the Des Moines Register over the weekend that he had shot his girlfriend in the head, the mother of his 3-month-old baby, and then gone over to the stadium and in the presence of a couple of team leaders had shot himself. And all of the reporting on it focused on the tragedy of his death and the trauma of on members of his team and also those people who had witnessed him killing himself. But there was almost no mention of the domestic violence aspect of it. The fact that he had taken another person's life, the 22-year-old mother of his child, his girlfriend. And I started to read a little bit more about the circumstances of that. And, you know, it turned out he was mad at her because she had gone to a concert, because she was stressed out about the constant need for taking care of the baby, and she was doing it pretty much alone because he was on the road all the time. And his mother had come and was staying with them to look after the baby, so she needed a little time for herself. And she came home late, and they got into a fight, and he yelled at her, and he shot her. And I just thought, you know, that story gets lost in the reporting. And it's so often that kind of context about male violence, about sort of notions of machismo, what makes a man feel entitled to do something like that, that we don't explore enough in our culture and that we need to do a lot more examination of. So my column today is about that. And that's often, you know, the process that I use, is trying to think about the person who isn't written about, the person whose story isn't told, and what are the messages that we can learn from it. And ironically, this man Belcher was actually, when he was in college, he had signed on to a, you know, some kind of a renouncing violence pledge he had taken. But obviously that didn't go very deep.
Domestic violence is a subject that comes up a lot in a lot of different ways in many of your columns. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me, and it struck me when I was reading the column that you wrote in 2009 about Roxanne Conlon. Mm-hmm. And you wrote about the violence in her family when she was a child and the fact that she called the cops on her dad because he would abuse her mom and made her first court appearance when she was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. In an effort to defend her family. But there were a couple of other places in the book where you are writing about women who, you know, we would all see as very successful, confident women who had something like that in their past. Mm-hmm. And even in their deep past. Is that a pattern that you found?
You know, I actually, let me just say this, and I wanted to say this in the earlier segment. Writing these columns has been an incredible education for me. It has taught me so much more about the realities of women's lives than I ever understood from a theoretical perspective when I was studying these issues in grad school or writing about them theoretically before I started to come here and really interview people about their lives. And, you know, domestic violence is just absolutely epidemic in our society and in all societies, and it is still, to a large extent, an untalked about subject. So someone like Roxanne Conlon, who is a very powerful, high power attorney who just wins an incredible number, you know, 90% of her cases, had this dark secret in her past. And she hadn't talked to anyone about it, even during her race for governor many years ago. But when she ran for Senate this time a couple of years ago, she decided it was time to talk. And I knew about it, and I asked her to sit down with me for an interview. And she was willing to do it. And she revealed the vulnerable side of Roxanne Conlon. And I think that reading stories about like this are important for two reasons. One, because they show us how rampant a societal ill like domestic violence is and how we have to work to combat it. But they also give hope to women who have been victims that you can really make something of yourself. You can get empowered. You can become an activist for a cause. And, you know, you can become very successful in your life. But it is incredible to me how many women who we look at as very successful, and even men, have something very difficult and very painful in their pasts.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 866-780-9100. And Mary is on the line from Keokuk County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And, Rekha, I have to tell you, you are an inspiration to all women. And I love your column. Oh. And I was a woman who read about the incident at Washington County Jail with the illegal alien young man who was the victim of a rape. And I just wanted to remind you that you have written social justice articles informing us of horrific crimes against people who, once again, regardless of gender, have no recourse.
Well,
so
thank you.
Thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Mary. I really appreciate the call.
Mm-hmm. Mary, thank you for calling the show. And you, of course, have written about both men and women over the years. Why did you choose to put out a collection of the columns about women?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, initially we toyed, and the Des Moines Register published this book, so this was obviously done collaboratively with my editors. We toyed with the idea of just doing a general compilation of columns, but it seemed too broad and diffuse, and I really thought it needed to have a focus. I could have, you know, I could have put out a book about immigrants. I mean, I typically tend to write about people, as I mentioned, who are either other or from the wrong sides of the tracks or who are in some way lacking in power and lacking in a voice. Women was a subject, frankly, closest to home. You know, it's a subject I've probably focused more of my columns on women and women's issues than anything else. And the challenge here was to, frankly, make it not be a downer book, because a lot of these stories that I've written are about, you know, terrible things happening to women, women struggling, women being disenfranchised in one way or another, or, you know, being abused, sexually harassed, and so on. But we wanted it to ultimately be an uplifting book, to sort of show women's voices in all their beauty and diversity, and also give people hope about what they can do, and really pay tribute to the strength of women who are confronting some sort of societal injustice. So, you know, again, it was part of my education. And there's really a very wide variety of columns in this book. Some of them are not about a wrongdoing. Some of them are about, for example, there's one about a person who went through a transition, who's transgendered, who went through a female-to-male transition. And I really learned a lot in the process of writing that piece about what it feels like to be transgendered and to feel as if you were born into the wrong gender, just into the wrong body, and what that process is like. And I was so grateful to her for stepping forward and wanting to share her story, because I think it educated so many people. And then there are some stories, columns that I wrote that illustrated a particular point without lecturing. For example, I wrote a column about these Sudanese women who were walking 3 miles every morning to get to an English language class, sometimes with bare legs, no winter coats, and babies on their backs, because it was so important to them to learn English. And this was at the time that we were having these great debates about whether or not to pass an English-only law in Iowa, which I opposed. And rather than just writing theoretically about why we don't need one, I thought it was important to show through women's real lives and experiences why we don't need one, because they're actually doing this. They're taking it upon themselves under great duress to learn English because they know it's necessary to function. So, you know, there's so many, and some of these columns are not about gender-specific kinds of activism. There's one woman who really educated me by contacting me, asking me to come out to her rural Iowa home and experience what it is like to be living next to a hog confinement where these awful manure spills are happening and the odors are terrible, while she's trying to live kind of an organic and natural lifestyle. And I really learned a lot about hog confinements through her.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. I want to get back to the phones. You can join our conversation. I'm talking with Des Moines Register columnist Rekha Basu. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Angela's on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Angela.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've really enjoyed listening. Rekha, thanks for all your informative articles.
Thanks,
Angela. From your point of view, from observing Iowa from an outsider's point of view, have you seen significant improvements with women's rights, and in what areas, and how does that compare to the rest of the nation?
Ah, that's a really interesting question. I have seen a great deal of improvement. And one subset of women, by the way, who I write about a great deal have been lesbians. And I write about, in general, actually, gay and lesbian issues quite a bit. And one thing that I have really noticed is a greater embrace of the rights of gays and lesbians in our society. And when, you know, I had talked earlier about how we moved away to Florida for a year and came back at the end of 2001, beginning of 2002. And I got just a flood of letters. I think there was something like 700 letters I got after my first column back. And many of those people, both men and women, said, you know, I really sort of hated you before you left, and I didn't agree with any of your columns. But I missed you when you were gone. I missed your voice. I missed being challenged and provoked. And it then turned out, and this is what a huge subset of them said, that I had a son who was gay or a daughter who was a lesbian. And, you know, of course, a parent loves their child and will do anything to support them against what can sometimes be a very hostile society. And so, you know, then I missed your voice as a voice of advocacy for them. So that's on the one hand. Yes, in gay rights issues, I think we have come a long way. In other ways, you know, I've been sort of horrified by the degree of backlash that I sometimes see us experiencing. Recently, there was a case of domestic violence involving a former county attorney from Madison County. And this just kind of stunned me because I looked up his name. It rang a bell, and it took me back to a column I had written back in the 1990s about a really egregious case of domestic violence when he was the county attorney in Madison County, involving a woman whose ex-husband had come to her house late at night and forced his kind of way into the house and then tried to suffocate her over a period of hours, releasing and then, you know, again, stifling her. And what ended up happening, she called the police, she did everything right. What ended up happening was that she was prosecuted for facilitating the violation of a no-contact order, but he was not prosecuted for violating the no-contact order. And this was the same county attorney who, it now turns out, is accused of abusing his own domestic partner. So, yeah, you get where the mindset was coming from, but also some things are cyclical and don't change.
Now, that column was so heartbreaking, too, because she then chose not to renew a no-contact order because she was afraid of being prosecuted again.
Exactly, that it wasn't worth the piece of paper it was written on. But she did. But the plus side to that story is that she became herself an advocate for battered women and, you know, so used her horrible experience in some ways to empower other women.
Angela, thank you so much for your call. Rekha, how much do you follow up after you write a column? In putting this book together, clearly you went back and revisited a lot of these columns, and in the introduction you give us a few updates. Do you follow up on stories?
You know, I do follow up on some, but not enough, I have to say. So, you know, that's one thing, and that doesn't just apply to the columns in this book, but that applies to all of the columns that we as columnists write, is that, you know, we get so caught up in the kind of day-to-day business of putting out a column that you don't often go back to the people you've written about. And sometimes, though, you know, they come to us and tell us that there's been a development. And so that's really helpful. There's one column in the book about Heather Wright, a young student who was attending a Mason City high school. And she was so badly sexually harassed. She became absolutely the target of harassment because she had broken up with a boyfriend at her school, that horrible things were written about her on locker walls and around the school. And the school decided that it just couldn't protect her against any of this. So what it was going to do was remove her from the school setting altogether and have her go privately to the principal's office to take her classes, to take private lessons, instead of, you know, making the environment safe and cracking down on the guys who were harassing her. So years later, I wrote about this and I was just completely outraged. And years later, she filed a lawsuit and there was a settlement and she did, you know, receive some sum of money for this. So then I was able to go back and take a look at that case. You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, there are some stories that just have wings. One of the columns is about a woman who was a juror in a hung jury. She caused a jury to be hung, and that was the jury that was deliberating the fate of Heidi Anfinson, who was accused of murdering her newborn baby and actually convicted and This woman in the first trial said that she just didn't think she was guilty, and she just held out and held out and held out, and everybody was very angry at her for doing that, but she just couldn't see her, Anfinson, being a woman who would in cold blood murder her child. Eventually there was another trial and Anfinson was convicted, and she served, I think, something like 15 years in prison, and recently she came out. But in the meantime, we've learned a lot about postpartum psychosis and what that can do to women, and the fact that, you know, it is very likely that Heidi Anfinson was suffering from that when this horrible death of her infant occurred. So I made reference to what we now know in retrospect and what Joanne Saylor was onto when she hung that jury the first time around.
Thinking about that column, you often wade into these very controversial issues before we have all the facts, before really everything has come out. And I mentioned earlier that I thought in some ways your job was very vulnerable. Is that a frightening thing to do, to take a stand on something where, you know, you have an interpretation of what we've found out so far, but there's no way of really knowing everything yet?
You know, you have to be extremely careful in how you approach it. And yes, absolutely, you're absolutely right. That can be very dangerous if you're coming out supposing that something happened that didn't happen. So what I do in a case like that is I rely on, and you know, and so there's the problem that on the one hand, you want to be able to be a voice of advocacy for someone who is being unfairly treated by the system, but you have to have enough information before that case has been judged altogether that they are being unfairly treated by the system, that they were not culpable, that they, you know, that they didn't contribute to their own circumstances. And so one thing that I have done is relied on police. You know, even when a crime has not been prosecuted, for example, police will share with me, sometimes even off the record, that they believe that it was committed. So, you know, I try to go to a number of different sources to kind of verify what it appears to be happening from my perspective.
We need to take a short break. I'm talking with Rekha Basu. Her new book is called Finding Her Voice, a collection of Des Moines Register columns about women in the Midwest. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Rekha Basu. She's a columnist for the Des Moines Register, and she's just published a new book. It's called Finding Her Voice, a collection of Des Moines Register columns about women's struggles and triumphs in the Midwest. Rekha, did you go through every single column that's in the book? I understand it was a collaborative effort, but did you go back and read every single one?
I did. I did the selection, and I also did the categories. It's broken down into 8 different categories, beginning with writing her own script and then being silenced, and then about women becoming activists for a cause. There's one that links up, I think it's called Global is Local, and it talks about women in different countries, women's rights issues, and how we are connected to some of those issues. And then the final segment is called First Person Singular, and that's where I write about myself, some of the columns I wrote about myself. I did, though, Charity, want to get back to the question that you were asking me before the last break, because I think it's a really important one. And that is this question of how do you verify that something actually happened when you're going to take a position on it. And I want to talk about one particular column that I wrote that I think still to this day has had the greatest impact on me and on my writing. And that is one that has the headline is Dowling Punishing a Victim, and it's in the book. So back many years ago, now it's more than 15 years ago, there was a young woman who was a student at Dowling High School in Des Moines, and she alleged that she had been raped by a student at the same school. But what ended up happening was because she came from sort of the wrong side of the tracks, and this other student came from a prominent family who was more well-to-do and had more connections. And she started to act out, to mouth out, because she felt in her classes, you know, she was being disruptive and so on, because she felt that the school was not taking her side. Well, the school got, or doing anything to the boy. The school got so turned off by her behavior that they ended up expelling her, but they kept the boy on. And I read about this and was just sort of, outraged that this could happen. But first I had to call the West Des Moines police and say, you know, do you think this rape really occurred? Because it wasn't being prosecuted. And they said yes. They had investigated it and they thought she was absolutely telling the truth, and they thought that his story didn't square with what he said, but that hers did. So I wrote a column asking, and I didn't say Dowling is punishing a rape victim. I asked the question, is Dowling? So, you know, there are things that you can do so that it doesn't seem so airtight. But I was fairly convinced at that point that she had actually been raped and that she was telling the truth. And I was able to interview her for it. So years later, the boy transfers, moves to another state, and I get a call from a young woman in the state that he's moved to who says that she has been raped by him, and that when she went online and did a search about him, she found my column saying that he had raped someone else. And she just really wanted to talk to the other young woman to compare experiences and could I put them in touch. So that, again, gave me to believe that the story had had some merit. I put the two of them in touch. More years go by. It's about 15 years later. I've moved to Florida. I've come back. And one day I get a phone message, and it was left in the middle of the night on my work voicemail. And it's from this young woman. She's moved out of town. She's gotten her life together through a lot of counseling and empowerment. And she tells me that she has been carrying that column around in her wallet all of these years because she went through some really rough times where nobody believed her. And she was actually on the verge of killing herself a number of times, she said. But then she would take that column out and read it and know that someone had believed her. And it was what allowed her to keep going. And it honestly, it makes me emotional every time I talk about this. But it shows the power of believing in someone when no one else does. And sometimes you just have to take a risk.
That column clearly changed her life.
Changed mine, too.
Do you think that it also affected change of the system that allowed something like that to happen?
I certainly hope so. But there's no way of judging because stories like this continue to come up. You know, perhaps Dowling has done an evaluation of itself and looked at the way it treats people who are alleging, or other schools have. But there's just no way of knowing. All I've learned from it is the importance of believing people when nobody else does and when all evidence points to the fact that they are telling the truth and need support.
I'm talking with Reka Basu. She is a columnist for the Des Moines Register. We're talking about her new book, Finding Her Voice. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And Amy is on the line in Ames. Hi, Amy.
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to comment, and actually, thank you. I remember when you first started writing for the Register, and I was actually in junior high.
Oh, wow.
I grew up in Iowa, and I remember reading your columns and Rob's columns, and I remember at the time thinking it was such a change for the Register. You know, I'd grown up reading Chuck Offenberger, and and then you two come along, and it kind of upended writing a bit there. And
so
I,
what
like
was
people,
your first reaction? Were you angry? Were you pleased? What did you think?
I remember thinking it was just so different, and then I thought, you know, because I remember your columns evolving, and that when you guys first came and first started writing, and there was kind of like this, you know, what backwater have we landed in?
I'm sorry.
And especially more Rob's, definitely, I would say.
Yeah.
But so there were definitely times that I was like, you know, it's Iowa, it's not that bad. And then, but as time went on, and especially even after you guys left and came back, and it was like, you know, what we'd missed about Iowa, and it was like, wow, you know, they've come around. And it ended up, you know, my life actually had some of those elements as well, because I met, like many people, grew up here and went to school and left, mm-hmm. and came back, mm-hmm. and actually dragged a man from the East Coast that I had married back to Iowa.
And and how's he doing?
He's doing well, but I remember when Rob was first diagnosed, we were in Chicago, and I remember reading that article, and I was so struck by how, you probably hear this a lot from people, but it really did personally affect me, because I kind of did felt like I had, you know, I'd grown up reading you guys, mm-hmm. and he actually passed away shortly after my first son was born, and having had children yourself, I mean, you
understand
you're a little more
emotions.
Emotional during those times, and I remember being just so profoundly affected by that, but I never had the opportunity to thank him for the influence of his work and his columns. But so I wanted to be able to thank you and through that thank him as well. So you, I think you've done a lot, and you've done a lot for women. You've done a lot for the state of Iowa, I think. And to this day, I mean, I don't always agree with you. I didn't always agree with Rob. But just a couple
Neither
weeks
did
ago,
I. Nor he with me.
Ago, I had a discussion with my mother about one of your columns, and I remember doing that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and we're still doing it. So thanks for your work.
Wow. Your call means so much to me. I mean, thank you so much for calling. You know, when Rob was diagnosed with ALS and he made it public in the newspaper and we both started writing about it, it was incredible what an outpouring of support we found from Iowans and complete strangers. We would learn that someone in a rural church somewhere had publicly offered a prayer in his name, or we would, when he could still eat, you know, we would go to a restaurant and someone at the next table would pick up the tab and leave without, you know, taking any acknowledgement or leaving a name or anything. People would knit blankets who didn't know us and send them to him. And there was just, I mean, it just showed you how incredible the values of this community are in terms of supporting people that they care about.
We have another caller on the line. Chris is on the line now in Iowa City. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, thank you for taking my call. And Reku, thank you so much for your work. And this program has been great. I wanted to comment about the NFL player. Mm-hmm. And that was my first when I heard the story. And then, you know, you hear it again and you see it in the paper. And nothing was talked about the girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and even the three-month-old that now didn't have parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what is it? You know, and I live in Iowa City, the University of Iowa. Football is king here.
Right.
And there's so much that is glossed over.
Yes.
With sports and yes. the domestic violence aspect. And so I just want to thank you for, you know, making that or writing that article today and just bringing that to light, because I think that everyone was so focused on, oh, this NFL player. It's like there are other people involved, and, you know, another woman is dead
because
of this domestic violence.
That's
situation.
Exactly right. I mean, he had the right, however tragic, to take his own life. He did not have the right to take hers. And, you know, that was just not the focus of any of the coverage in the immediate aftermath. And yes, you live in Iowa City, and, you know, we think about the University of Iowa as a very progressive and wonderful institution. But, you know, at that institution, as well as every other one, there has been sexual violence towards women. There have been rapes by members of sports teams, and they have been mishandled. It's quite universal, actually. And you know, for some reason, there's something in the culture of sports and universities that makes these kinds of cover-ups and this kind of wrongdoing able to flourish unaddressed and unchecked. Hopefully, some changes are being made now at the university that will separate functions and responsibilities for investigating crimes of sexual violence. But that's a big issue, and that's also been a big topic of many of my columns.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. And we have this email from Mike in Ames. He said, "While I often agree with Ms. Basu's columns, I also find myself in disagreement often. I always read them as whatever I think about them, they're always thought-provoking." And he goes on to say that in the case of treatment of survivors of sexual assault and domestic abuse, Iowa had some of the earliest examples of offering services, such as the Polk County Rape Crisis Center, established, I think, in 1974, which became Polk County Victim Services, the sexual assault program in Iowa City, the Polk County Family Violence Center, which also dates back to the 70s. There were other examples of services, rudimentary though they may have been, with various locations as early as the 70s. I think making the case that victims of sexual assault and domestic abuse are often mistreated and re-victimized, and that services are not universally available, is strengthened if one is aware of and acknowledges the sort of history that I mentioned, but one has to know about it to do so. By the way, making this particular case effectively is as important as ever, as funding for these programs has been reduced and continues to be in jeopardy. That's again from Mike and Ames, but you do point that out in your book and in various columns through the years. You talk about Iowa as a progressive state, in law at least.
Absolutely. I think Iowa has been incredibly progressive in many ways. I do talk about the fact that, you know, at a time when people from Nebraska had to come to the state to have interracial marriages, Iowa was allowing it. I wrote about Edna Griffin, who 7 years before Rosa Parks sparked the Montgomery bus boycott, began a protest of her own against Katz's Deli in Des Moines. She was an African-American woman who had moved to town, was married to a doctor, and they refused to serve her ice cream on a hot day because she was black. And she organized a boycott of the place, and it was successful. Many people sat outside of the deli day after day until some justice was won, and a court case was won against Katz's Deli. Unfortunately, the jury only awarded her $1 in damages. But Iowa also was progressive in having the first anti-stalking law in the nation. Iowa gave us Carrie Chapman Catt, who was an early fighter for women's right to vote. So, yes, absolutely, Iowa has been on the cutting edge of many, many of these things. I mean, the problem is that sometimes the practice and the follow-up are not always there. It's not that the laws are wrong or the procedures that are supposed to be followed are not in place. It's that they're not followed.
In looking back through all of these columns, we have just a couple of minutes left, but you know, I was struck reading through the columns at so many things that had happened in your own life. And of course, when you moved here, your boys were small, they're grown now, you've lost your husband, you've been through so much. Was it interesting for you to look at the woman that you were when you first wrote those mm-hmm. columns in 1991 and 1992, and then to look at who you are today?
That's such a great question. Gosh, yeah. I mean, I've grown old in this state in positive ways. I have, I think, grown into myself. I have found my own voice in the process of trying to give voice to other people. And it has been an incredible experience. And for everything that we've been through and for as tough as it has been, I wouldn't change who I am now or what I've learned. You know, some of the lessons that I've learned or the strength that I've gotten. I have to say that, you know, so when you move to a place that you're not from, you tend to rely a lot on friends who become sort of surrogate family members for you. And I have this incredible group of friends in Des Moines who are just here for me constantly and who have become indistinguishable from family. And so I owe a lot to them for keeping me going through some of the tougher times and for being there continuously like godparents to the kids, seeing them grow, helping them grow, helping keep us on track, all of that. So I'm really incredibly indebted to this state and to the people of it.
Do you feel like an Iowan now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am an Iowan. And, you know, at times that has been a little problematic, because I remember even a few years into my time here, I felt that I was just becoming kind of too nice and not edgy enough. And I remember writing a column saying, you know, am I losing my edge in Iowa? Because it's easy not to see really painful, difficult things around you. Life here is in general very comfortable for those of us who are middle class and have some privileges. And so, you know, you have to go looking for hardships, whereas in a city like New York, it's all around you, even making, you know, the subway trip from the airport to your apartment, there is real life hardship and struggle. It's in your face. But there's also sort of an advantage, I think, to coming from another place and being able to reflect back to a community what you see in it, rather than being so entrenched that you sometimes can't step outside of it and see things for what they are. But I guess I wouldn't trade that sense of belonging that I've developed, because this is home and I love it here.
Reka, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been wonderful.
Reka Basu is a columnist for the Des Moines Register. A new collection of her work has just been published. It's called Finding Her Voice, a collection of Des Moines Register columns about women's struggles and triumphs in the Midwest. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Allison Sullivan and technical support from John Pemble in Des Moines. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, musician Dan Knight will be here. He'll bring his keyboard and we will reminisce about Christmas music, and he'll play many, many songs for us tomorrow. I hope you'll join us. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.